That'd be great. Okay, so now that I'm doing this, I kind of regret putting this in the series because like, I don't want to speak on prayer dilemmas. I don't want to speak about why God doesn't answer prayer sometimes. That's, I don't know. And actually, it's such a real, live and painful issue for a lot of people. And, you know, probably people in this room have got prayers that they've prayed for many years that they haven't seen God answer, or haven't even sensed that God's heard, maybe. And I know that's a very live issue for a lot of people. But actually, if you pray at all, you probably encounter this issue of unanswered prayer. And what do we do when we feel like God isn't responding to our prayers? And actually, you know, when I first became a Christian, I was 15 years old, and everything felt so easy then. I don't know about you, but, you know, I was so enthusiastic, and this was kind of my understanding. And it was kind of like a formula or an equation that God is all-loving. He loves us all completely. He's also all-powerful. He can do anything he wants. And he also knows everything. You know, he's just, he's God, isn't he? If you add to that prayer in response to a need or suffering, then that equals problem fixed, surely. And that was my understanding in the early days of my faith. That's just the way it works. And I guess in those early days, I walked through a situation with a very close friend of mine who suffered. He was suffering a lot. Some of it was self-inflicted. Some of it was inflicted by well-meaning Christians. And some of it was just the circumstances of his life. But it actually took him to some really dark places. And as a teenager, I walked through that with him for a couple of years. And I prayed for him because I was quite a new Christian. And some days were really good. He'd ring me in the evening and he'd say, "Oh, I've had a great day." And I said, "I prayed that you'd have a great day." And it felt, yes, God's answering my prayer. And then other days I'd pray for him and he'd ring me and say, "Oh, this has happened and that's happened and it's been terrible." And it felt like three steps backwards. And the question was, why did that happen? And to be honest, in my formula and equation, there was enough of the good stuff to kind of keep it intact a little bit, I could sweep the unanswered stuff under the carpet a little bit and keep my understanding intact. But if that felt like a spanner in the works, I guess some things feel like a complete atom bomb in the works, don't they? And sometimes there aren't things you can sweep under the carpet anymore. Some things feel too big. When you're praying for someone that's got chronic pain and it's day after day after day, we have a friend like this from my home church back home, and all her life she's lived with this terrible pain that's just kept her from living the kind of life she would have wanted to. What do you do with that when God doesn't seem to be answering that prayer? Or when good people have good desires and it just, those are never realized for them. And they feel so much bigger than a spanner in the works or something you can sweep under the carpet. And for me, I've turned to the Bible so many times on this. And actually, I've never found an answer to why God doesn't answer prayer that satisfies me. I've found things that I kind of can rearrange things a little bit and still my formula still feels okay. But some of the bigger things I've encountered as I've gone, that just doesn't seem to work anymore. It's not a formula. Prayer isn't a formula. X plus Y equals Z. It doesn't work like that. But when I have come to the Bible, what I've discovered is something that I think is so much better. And I really do believe this is better. I find a God in the Bible that identifies with us in our confusion and in our suffering and in our unanswered prayers. In the book of Job, which is just a bit of a masterpiece on this whole issue, Job's obviously, if you don't know the story, Job is this faultless man. He's very righteous. He's a righteous, religious man before God. And Job loses everything. He loses his property, he loses his family. Everything that could go wrong goes wrong in the life of Job. And the book of Job is about what happens then in terms of trying to come to terms with, why has this happened? Why, you know, I pray and God doesn't seem to answer. Why is that? And his friends come up with all these explanations and all attempts to try and explain why the prayers aren't answered. At the end, God says, you're speaking falsely about me. All your speculation is speaking falsely about me. And Job, who doesn't really try and work it out necessarily, doesn't come to any conclusions. God says, Job's spoken truthfully about me. And I think we need to be careful about speculating about why God doesn't answer prayers, especially when we're going to share that with people who are suffering. I've got a book that I was going to show you, actually, because I think, actually, this is a great book to read on this subject. It's called Ruthless Trust. Has anyone read Ruthless Trust? It's a book by a Catholic theologian called Brennan Manning. And in it, he quotes another Catholic philosopher called Dupré. It's probably not the way you say it. Dupré? I don't know. I think he's French. Who says this? He says, evil or pain or suffering invites philosophical speculation. I'll let you rest with that for a second. Evil invites philosophical speculation. We look at it and we try and work out why. Yet, it is the cliff on which philosophy suffers shipwreck. It is the cliff on which philosophy suffers shipwreck. It just doesn't add up when we try and work it out like that. So, we're going to turn to this passage in a moment. But we're going to turn to it not to try and look for answers on why God doesn't answer some prayers. But we're going to turn to it to look for a God who identifies with us in our pain and suffering and confusion. Another author that I really enjoy, Brian McLaren, who writes on Christian living, all kinds of stuff. But this is one of the things he says of the Bible, that the Bible is the family album that carries the memories of ancestors who managed to keep their faith, hope, and love alive in a world that shocked them, rocked them, and mocked them. I'll read that again. It's the family album that carries the memories of ancestors who managed to keep their faith and hope and love alive in a world that shocked them, rocked them, and mocked them. It's not an answer book. It's not an answer book. It doesn't give us all the answers to life. It's a book in which we find meaning and comfort for our own walk with God in life. So we're going to turn to this passage, which is possibly the most famous unanswered prayer of them all, isn't it? Jesus' prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus praying, Lord, he knows he's about to approach the cross. He knows he's about to suffer. He's been talking about it. He's been telling his disciples about it. But then, at the crucial moment just before his journey to the cross, he comes to this point and he says, God, do I have to go through this? Is there another way? Is there another way? If there is, please take this cup from me. But not what I will, but what you will be done. And just, I want to start with a little bit of context about it, because I reread this passage several times this week, and it's easy with a passage like this to think of it from the perspective of, oh, we know what happens, therefore we gloss over some of what Jesus is going through here. Because, you know, we know the end of the story. If you don't know the end of the story, Jesus dies, and then he rises to life again, and he conquers death. But when you don't know that from this perspective, this is quite a shocking passage. Because the Jesus we've encountered so far in the Gospels, I don't know about you, but I think of Jesus as just this uber-confident character. He, you know, He gets called all sorts of stuff that would make me sort of whimper and shrivel up. You know, he gets called a son of the devil and all this sort of stuff. And he's just, he's not fazed by it. He knows his identity, so he knows who he is in God. He knows who God is, and he knows the plan. He talks about the plan, you know, I'm going to suffer. And he tells his disciples that. So he's just got this air of confidence about him. Contrast that to this Jesus that we encounter in this passage. And imagine what these disciples would have thought as they saw him. And we're going to touch on a little bit why maybe he took the disciples with him at this moment. He took the disciples with him and he's in anguish, it says. He sweat like drops, it's like drops of blood. He's in real turmoil. It's a real vulnerable Jesus that we've not seen anywhere else. When I was growing up, I didn't see my parents cry, you know. They were that sort of confident, you know. They didn't show me that side of themselves. And so on the very, very rare occasion that I saw that, it shocked me and it rocked me. And it made me think, this isn't right. What's wrong? Because I'd never really seen that in them. And I wonder whether it was a little bit like this. But I think Jesus is trying to show them something here. So Jesus takes his disciples with him to the garden. Why does he do that? I think it's this. In the defining moments of life, the moments that really matter, we need people to stand with us. You know, as people of faith, we'd say we need people to pray with us. Even the Son of God needed that. You know, I have friends, I've talked about this before, but I have friends who would drop everything, and it says more about them than me, this is why I'm saying this, that would drop everything if I drop everything. That's our friend Sally there, just come for moral support, thanks. who'd drop everything to come and support me in a time of need, and I've had that, and they have done that. So he takes his disciples with them, and he says to them this, he says, pray so that you do not fall into temptation. I was wondering this week, I was going to skip over this bit, because I thought, I don't really get it, I don't know why he's saying that. But actually, what is the temptation? What are they going to be tempted by at this point? I don't know. But maybe it's the temptation to let fear and doubt overwhelm them rather than to turn to prayer, to actually become so overwhelmed by what they're going through that overtakes them. He says, pray so that you don't fall into temptation. Maybe it's the temptation to run away, to, you know, Peter, one of Jesus' disciples, has already said to him when he said, I'm going to suffer, no, you're not. It's not going to happen. And Jesus is like, I am. Get behind me. This is the way it's got to be. So maybe it's the temptation to run away or to conjure up an alternative plan. And he says, no, we've got to go through this suffering. This is important. So pray that we don't try and avoid this. I also think that Jesus is doing something really important here. And it goes back to what I've just said about my parents. And this isn't a criticism of my parents at all. but I think Jesus is modeling the path of suffering. He tells his followers time and again, you will suffer. You will suffer in this world. You know, John and I were talking this week, and I was talking about Richard Rohr, who's another Catholic. I love Catholic theologians, don't I? I quote them all the time. But he says in one of his things that the Bible, the majority of the Bible, is written from the side of the oppressed. Most of history is written from the side of the victors, but the Bible is so unusual because it's written from the margins, mostly, which is something really unusual. It's written by the suffering. And I think Jesus is taking his disciples with him because he's saying, you're going to suffer. Watch me. Watch how I do it. Watch how honest and vulnerable I am. Watch how I don't try and run away or explain everything or defend God. That I face this suffering because actually you're going to go through this too. And you need to see this for your own agonies ahead. And Jesus is before them. He's honest. He pours out his soul. He asks for an alternative. And I got to thinking, you know, as people of faith, if you're a person of faith, do we model that kind of honesty ourselves? Or are we quick to jump and defend God? Are we quick to try and find an explanation for why our prayers aren't answered? Oh, it's because of this, but God's still good. Or actually, do we face it and say, we don't know why, but we trust that God is with us? I also find it interesting that he takes really imperfect people with him. I think that's brilliant because, you know, he tells them to pray and they fail and he goes away and he comes back and he's like, you're asleep again. What are you doing? But these are the people he takes with him, and we're those people too, and he takes us with him. And actually, we need to take one another with us, even though, with all our imperfections, even though we let each other down, to let each other into our own pain and suffering and take that journey together. So he takes the disciples with him. But then he does something else. It says that, what does it say in the NIV? I was reading a different version. He withdrew about a stone's throw beyond them. That's striking, isn't it? That he took them so far, but then he withdrew. Because when we're going through stuff, when we are facing these big questions, when we come face to face with our suffering, with our unanswered prayers, that's a really lonely place. Especially when other people seem to be getting their prayers answered. You know, I used to go to, you know, if you don't know, I used to work at another church around the corner called Woodlands, and we used to have these staff meetings, and people would share all these answers to prayer. And if you're sat there thinking, oh, God's not really been answering my prayers this week, and you're hearing all those amazing stories, it can feel a bit lonely sometimes to be in that place. And there are some places we need to go alone with our unanswered prayers, with our questions, with our suffering. We need people with us. But there's a place where people can't go with us, where there are no more resources. And that this is the picture. Jesus doesn't have a crutch. He doesn't have any more resources. He's got nothing. This is a picture of utter helplessness. And I think that is because it's only at that point that you can really surrender. That you can really surrender to God and say, not my will, but yours be done. When you don't have a crutch anymore, when you don't have any other support, that's when you say to God, okay, over to you. Not my will, but yours be done. And that is a prayer that lives with unanswered questions, isn't it? It's not one that tries to work out the why. Although we might be able to do some of that. But it's the prayer that lives with uncertainty. It's a prayer of faith, actually. And it's at that point that it says, an angel from heaven appeared to him and strengthened him. At that point, when he completely surrenders, that's when God's resources kick in. And it's a strength that comes from completely letting go. And that is part of the story of the Bible, isn't it? That strength is found in weakness. That when we run out of our own resources, when we say, God, I can't do it anymore, that's when we meet God and meet God's strength. So, I'm closing now, and we're going to move into a time of communion. But if you're living with unanswered prayer this morning, I guess my prayer is that as a community we stand together with all our own, we've all got needs, we've all got our imperfections too, but we stand together in that place of unanswered prayer. And my prayer is also that you and I know the love of God who suffered himself and identifies with us in our suffering. And that as we come weak to the table this morning, that we find strength. strength in God. So can we just pray, and then I'm going to hand back to Sarah. Lord, thank you that the message of the Bible is not that you are distant and aloof, but you are present with us in our journey of life, and that includes our suffering. That the message of the life and death and resurrection of Jesus is one of identifying with us in our suffering. And this morning, as we come to communion, Lord, would we identify with you in your life and death, but also in your resurrection, the hope beyond the grave, beyond it all. Amen.
Thank you, Simon.